Welcome to Making Sense of MarTech, a podcast about, well, making sense of MarTech. I'm Juan Mendoza. I'm your host. I'm also the CEO and author of the MarTech Weekly, a weekly email and newsletter that covers the most important shifts in the marketing technology industry. People work in some of the world's largest media tech and marketing companies. Read it. You can read, listen, and subscribe at themartechweekly.com. Okay, for this podcast, I have Tim Mason and Sarah Jarvis joining us. Tim is the CEO of Eagle Eye, a leading loyalty and personalization platform, and a top 10 TMW 100 global innovator that did very well in our inaugural event, tracking the most innovative marketing technology companies globally. Tim has spent more than 30 years building loyalty strategies in retail, including working as a deputy CEO and the CMO of Tesco UK PLC. Also joining us is Sarah Jarvis. She's a senior marketer. She's also at Eagle Eye, and she's a regular contributor to Forbes UK. Now, both Sarah and Tim have recently released the second edition of a book entitled Omnichannel Retail, How to Build Winning Stores in a Digital World. It was this very book that I actually wrote an essay for in the MarTech Weekly, calling it an apology for Omnichannel, because for years I was critical of the concept, but it wasn't until I actually read Tim and Sarah's book that it changed my mind on the value and importance of Omnichannel in business and what promise it actually has for a lot of marketers looking to improve customer experiences and drive growth. So in this episode, we talk about that. We explore what Omnichannel is. We hear Tim and Sarah's case for its importance in business. We also discuss the ethical considerations businesses face in the pursuit of what I call omniscient customer knowledge, which is effectively all the things you need to know about the customers in their interaction to offer them an omnichannel experience. We also talk about data privacy and how that plays an omnichannel strategy. Additionally, we explore successful examples of customers implementing omnichannel strategies and what that looks like on the ground. We examine challenges that a lot of organizations encounter when it comes to omnichannel, things like internal politics and coordination and getting resources to do it and influencing the executive leadership to get buy-in for omnichannel plans and strategies, plus many, many more topics. And so it is my great pleasure to bring you Tim and Sarah. How are you doing, Tim? How are you doing, Sarah? I know that you're dialing in from London today. It must be absolutely freezing.
Cold and wet, but we're good.
Cold and grey and almost dark, but thank you for staying up so late for us in Melbourne.
That is totally a pleasure on my side. I've been looking forward to this conversation for months since I read your book. This was about 4 months ago since I read it. So I'm really keen to learn a bit about your experience working both at Eagle Eye and also with brands, figuring out how to do omnichannel well. But before we get there, I want perhaps, Tim, if you could give us a bit of a view on what that experience was actually writing Omnichannel. Now it's in its second edition and Sarah's jumped on board to create that second edition. But when you wrote the initial book, what were you trying to do and what was that experience with just going through that process of writing a book around such a complex topic?
Well, it's not a joy, I would say. It's certainly not something that I sort of ever really intended or planned to do. I think that it was a way of telling the story, and it was a way of explaining why the business that we both work for, Eagle Eye, actually had an important role to play in contemporary and future marketing. I was very fortunate. I'm a marketeer by training. I started my career as a Unilever marketing trainee. I then joined Tesco as a product manager and spent 30 years going through Tesco, working for a guy called Terry Leahy, who was also a marketeer. And we had an amazing run. When we joined the business, it had a 12% market share. When we left the business, it had over a 30% market share, which in a market like that is quite an achievement. We took a business that was sort of down at heel, pilot high, sell it cheap, until it turned it into a world leader. And the principal driving force behind that was marketing. So as a marketeer, I'm keen to show people how marketing can be the leading growth engine for driving business success. Now, like every other walk of life in the 2020s, marketing now has a digital component and a technical component. And, you know, if you're going to be a good baker in 2020, you need to be a good technologist. If you're going to run a good bakery business, you can't just be good round the oven. It just doesn't work anymore. That same applies to marketing. So interestingly, in your introduction, when you talk about all the issues of alignment and structure and culture and all those other things, which 20 years ago were a lifetime's work, all of those things still exist. They haven't gone away, but you've got this extra layer of technology that you also have to cope with in order to deliver effectively in the current world. So I thought that there was a story to tell. I thought it explained the role of our business and what we did. It's very much, we give it to people. And frankly, the reason why we wrote a second edition was because a few, not many, but a few people said, this book is absolutely brilliant. It's the best business book I've ever had. One lady said, it never leaves my side. It's always on my nightstand. And so I came back and I said to Sarah, because we were debating whether we should or shouldn't do a second edition, I came back and said to Sarah, we've got to do a second edition. And that's how Sarah joined me in creating the second edition, which I have to say I prefer quite significantly to the first edition.
So that experience was grounded in wanting to tell the story of, because you spent so much time building Tesco's marketing function, telling that story, but then also dovetailing that with how you think about it from a technological perspective. So for example, with Eagle Eye, it is a personalization platform, a loyalty platform. It should influence a lot of what you see in Omnichannel. And so it sounds like it was a bit of a dovetailing of the both.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah.
I wanted to call the book How to Out Amazon Amazon. But my publisher wouldn't let us on the basis that they hoped that Amazon would sell a lot of copies of the book and didn't think they would with that title. So the point is, I think that we all experience digital first businesses every day. You know, our first experience, if you're anything like me, your first experience of the day is a digital experience. You look at your phone and it's a sort of a digital experience that kicks the day off and gets you going. Showers are not yet digital, but, you know, pretty much there's quite a large digital component in it. And yet we refer to stores as digital black holes. So you use your phone and the mapping activity ability of your phone to get you to the shop door, you then put your phone in your pocket or purse and you go shopping. And what we're saying is that's a mistake, that the whole world is about being connected, and you need to make bricks and mortar shopping, restaurant eating, fashion shopping, all of those need to be a digitally connected experience. Forgive me, my dogs are starting the day as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. And you said earlier that Amazon I think that like that whole concept of out Amazoning Amazon is really interesting to me, because Amazon is the leader, the very pinnacle of doing a lot of this data-driven marketing within an e-commerce retail environment. Most retailers that I've spoke to in the past, they use Amazon as their guide, right? But I get a sense, Tim, that you were looking at Amazon as, yes, one force of change and innovation in retail, but you really wanted to carve your own path out in Tesco as well, not just follow the advice and best practice of Amazon.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Tesco clearly started before Amazon, although I think one of the things we did at Tesco is we started Tesco.com, which I think is probably the largest online grocer in the world. Still, I think it is. I'm not sure about that. I think it probably is. And It's either 1 year older or 1 year younger than Amazon. But clearly, Mr. Bezos had slightly bigger ambitions and a different shareholder base than Tesco had when we did it. But so, but I think, you know, Amazon is a remarkable thing. But it's not perfect. To just give you an example, in trying to work out how to monetize the platform, products come up in your search, which actually are not the products you're looking for, because they paid to get that place. Now that actually is a strategy which puts monetization above customer satisfaction, even though the business claims to be the most customer-centric business on the planet. Actually, that's not true. I'm not saying it's not customer-centric, but that is not an example of customer centricity. And so there is, and then if you take omnichannel, the enormous benefits of the bricks and mortar store is you get the feel, the smell, the touch, the texture, the taste. You can try it on. You can sample it. You can, there's a lot you can do and a lot we enjoy in a physical experience, which you can't do in a digital experience. So what you need to do is you need to take all that capability that you have from the physical experience, and you need to align it with digital tools so that you round it out and complete it. One of the great things that physical retailers do is they're curators, because you cannot get everything into a physical box. No matter how big that box is, even a Walmart supercenter, 200,000 square feet or whatever it might be, you still have to make choices. You still have to select. Whereas online, and indeed I would argue one of the problems is online, if you go and try and buy a pair of socks, you go, I haven't got a clue. They've certainly got a lot of socks. Yeah. But, if you want the cheapest ones, it's easy. But, it's just really difficult to tell what you should be buying. And so I think that this idea of curation, selection, and then you see the next problem with physical boxes is that because the human being is the search engine that navigates a physical box. So if you don't have a pet, you just don't go down the pet food aisle, just screen that whole part of the store out. So what you're doing is you're screening out to come down to stuff that's useful, interesting, and you can cope with. It's an easy example. If you have food intolerances, then a store's ability to know that about you and to give you an offer, communicate that there's a new range of gluten-free bagels, whatever it may be, is actually extremely valuable. Because you're never going to build a 4 foot high stack of gluten-free bagels in the front door of a shop with the sign saying, $1.99. It's just not going to happen, because that space is taken for a beer in some markets, not in Australia, I know, but, it's taken for some big highlight front of the flyer offer. But actually, I'm not interested in that product. What I'm interested in is gluten-free bagels, and I never get to hear about them. So unless I stumble across them as I navigate my way around the store, I don't know about them. And what you're creating through this digital connectivity is the ability to put a digital layer over the front of the shop that says, this will talk to things that you are interested in, that create value for you, whether it's literally in terms of prices and promotions that are offered, or in terms of information, advice, ranging, whatever it may be.
It's interesting because, you know, if you take the two trajectories of, say, Tesco and Amazon, you know, Tesco started as a retail business, as physical storefronts, whereas Amazon started as a digital business. And so even the nature of how they serve their customer and the wealth of knowledge and all of the regional and local variations and all of that is so different, because Amazon is global first, doesn't matter where you live, whereas Tesco is, yeah, we want stores in certain locations with a certain amount of population of people, and it becomes a local hub as well. So I can kind of see how the Tesco view on things is very much, how do we make the experience of shopping the best it can possibly be with any kind of channel, with any experience and technology, whereas Amazon is a scale game, because it's the experience, like, let's be honest here, right? Amazon's website hasn't changed a lot in many, many years. Haven't got the best UI. They've actually, the FTC right now is going after Amazon for some of their deceptive dark patterns for the Amazon Prime button. So, and you also mentioned the placement of ads and search results. And, you know, so there's a lot of misalignment happening in the digital ecosystem from the perspective of Amazon. Whereas, yeah, in a physical retail environment, like, yeah, the customer and their experience is so paramount, because everything is about the customer as soon as you open the doors and people start walking in. So it is quite interesting thinking those two differences between retail and then like a digital first perspective. But I want to get into this discussion about omnichannel. Now, a little bit of a backdrop. I did a LinkedIn post, I think back in 2020, where I said, good morning to everyone, except for people who use the word omnichannel. And you know what? I had a pretty severe reaction to that. I had folks saying, Juan, you can't say that. You know, there's tech companies that, you know, have huge amounts of value locked up in omnichannel. You can't really be talking about that. You know, and then others saying, what do you mean? It's a great concept. And then others agreeing with me saying, well, yeah, what is this word? It just seems like it was kind of invented out of nowhere. What does it actually mean? And so since then, I was kind of labeled a little bit as the omnichannel guy that doesn't really like the word omnichannel. But once I read your book, I got a good view on like the value of omnichannel as a distinct concept, a business strategy, and a way of thinking about using technology with a really good focus on customer experience. Now, I don't want to make the argument. I actually, Sarah, I'd love to throw to you, and I would love for you to open us up and just give us the edges, the definition of how you understand omnichannel, and what's the argument here, the best possible case for omnichannel in business.
Easiest if you think about it from your own perspective rather than thinking about like technology. But it's just a reality of how each of us shop and live in the world today. So I think like the latest data says more than 60% of global retail sales are digitally influenced. But we know in most markets, about 80% of sales are still happening in stores, which means that we are touching across our shopping journey apps, laptops, websites, going into physical stores, buying on the store, on your phone while you're in the store. There is no experience that you have with big retailers that is purely in one form or another. So it's just how we interact with brands. You're buying online and you're picking up in store and you're ordering home delivery. And you are doing that with your relationship with the brand, not with your relationship with the channel that that brand is serving you in at that particular time. So the irritation factor from a customer point of view happens when those things don't line up. If I want to shop with Tesco in its app, in a physical store, in a hypermarket, in its clothing part of the business, I want all of those experiences to be aligned. I want to pay the same prices across all of them. I want the brand to talk to me in the same way across all of them. When I see an advert, I want it to make sense for how I experience that brand. And people, you know, 10 years ago might have got away with those things being disconnected, but because of how we interact with the world, primarily through our phones, you are used to everything being curated just for you. I go onto Spotify, my playlists are made just for me. I go onto Netflix, everything's curated just for me. So as soon as that experience doesn't align and a business, you don't get the sense that they're understanding you in the same way across all of those channels, it's an irritation factor and someone else will be doing it better. So you can, you know, switch off quite easily. So I think it's more less of an argument from a what is the technology like solution, but in fact it's just a reality of how we live and how we shop, and businesses need to get with the program.
It is interesting thinking about that, because what I'm hearing is that this concept of omnichannel is about consistency of customer experience. So you can go to any Tesco store, let's use Tesco for example, go to any Tesco store and the prices are the same, you know, or the placement is similar. You know, there's a consistency aspect of this. There's a convenience aspect, you know, being able to buy online and pick up in store, give customers multiple options for how they want to shop in the way that suits them best. You know, so there's convenience. You know, and then there's also, I would say, perhaps even an element of care, like customer care, knowing if their customer has an outstanding complaint, maybe don't send them ads, you know,
or
knowing that there are certain, as you mentioned earlier, actually, Tim, about gluten intolerance, right? Like caring for the customer in a specific way as you know more about them. But am I missing anything? I mean, if we're talking about the themes of omnichannel, it's about the consistency, comfort or the convenience, and also the care. What else would you add to that picture, Tim?
Well, I think it's all elements of your relationship with a brand and making sure that they're consistent across all the elements of your brand. You know, there are still retailers who either can't or really struggle to run the same promotional program in their online format as their in-store format. There are still businesses who struggle to get their loyalty program to read across all their formats so that you've got an up-to-date view of how many points you've earned, what value you've got, what promotions you've got, that those promotions are ready for use, etc. So I think in all elements, it's saying we want our business to be consistent. We want the experience to be consistent. We want to take the knowledge of the whole customer, their searching behavior, their app use, their online shopping, their in-store shopping, things they look at. We want to take all of that in order to be able to represent to them the very best version of our brand. And I would define the very best version of our brand as being the version of our brand that is most suitable to them. It's driven by them. It's driven by their behavior and their activity. Because otherwise, as Sarah says, if you don't do that, you end up falling short of what people experience every day. And so, you know, they start putting that business or indeed that sector in a category which just goes, it's not really great. You know, I don't really like it that much. I mean, I love books. And I went to a small town last weekend and I went to a really nice bookshop. But actually didn't have anything I wanted to buy. And I went home that night and I ordered the two books I wanted to buy from Amazon. Not because I wanted to, but just because, you know, so that's a bit of an issue, isn't it? You know,
it is an issue. I think that your conceptualization of omnichannel being actually a big part of a brand is something I actually haven't heard before, which is this whole idea of, yeah, like the brand is held in the customer's mind and their perception of the delivery of the services and the products and what they receive in value. So in that sort of framing, the omnichannel really plays a huge role in that, really impressing upon the customer a certain definition of the brand. As you say, is it consistent? Is it adding something tailored to the customer? Are they able to quickly find what they need? You know, there's a billion and one questions when customers are shopping, but omnichannel tries to tackle that to say, well, if we give them the best possible version of the brand, in a way that suits them the most, then you're going to get better loyalty. You're going to get repeat purchase. You're going to get all these incredible values. And that's perhaps another side of the coin here, because we've talked a lot about customer centricity so far. But what about the business value aspect of this? I mean, how do you guys think about omnichannel as a concept, say, you know, pitching this to an executive team or a, you know, head of digital or head of marketing? You know, how would you frame the business value of this in terms of tangible marketing metrics or business metrics?
I think you can probably put together a pretty mechanistic business case that says digitally engaged customers are X percent more active. You've created a media channel of Y media value. You can do performance marketing, so you can measure the return on investment of every promotion. You can put together a pretty strong business case, which sits behind it. But actually, for me, and this is not me, Tim Mason, software salesman, this is me, Tim Mason, what's your view of how you make money in the world? And the way you make money, the way you make money in the world is by doing what we call, which is following the golden rule, which is about treating people the way they want to be treated. Mm. And indeed, Sarah and I are so excited about being co-authors. We're going to launch a blog in the new year. You heard it here first, which is all about
exclusive,
which is exclusive. Which is all about following the golden rule. And because I think you made a very important point in your summing up of what I said, which is brands exist in people's minds. That's where they live. That's what they are. And if you have a version, I think a classic destroyer of brand value has been click and collect.
Fascinating. Okay.
Because many people have recognized quite rightly, click and collect, super convenient. I don't have to be at home. It's a great thing to do. Oh, and by the way, they have to come to the store as well. So they might come in and they might spend a little bit more. And wouldn't that be brilliant if they did? So they get into click and collect, but they don't have the right systems that sit behind it. They don't have the right omnichannel view. They don't create enough space for the product to be ordered and handled properly. And they don't have enough staff to deliver it properly. So if you think about your early experiences of click and collect, there's some poor soul at a counter desperately looking for what your package, you know, they don't even have a package sorting methodology. And that was how most of us experienced click and collect, because people were trying to shoe it in to an operating model that wasn't omnichannel. So it's not just you've got to have the systems that link everything together. Yeah. You've got to have the infrastructure. You've got to have the buildings. You've got to have the staff. You know, you've got to deliver it across the piece. Otherwise, what you're doing through this little bolt-on is you're destroying what sits in people's brains about your brand. And that's incredibly value destructive.
Yeah. I've got a story on that. It perhaps illustrates the point, which is, so last year I bought a new MacBook, a brand new computer, but the process was teeth pulling, unbelievably painful. So I went onto a website, e-commerce website. It wasn't Apple, so it wasn't on seller. I said, oh, they've got, you know, Black Friday deals. Great. Okay. Buy a new MacBook Pro. They had an option in there for either click or collect or get it delivered by Uber. So an Uber driver would pick it up and bring it to my doorstep. So I paid the additional $15 and then I didn't get anything back. And then they said, oh, you know, it's going to be a delay. It's going to be a delay. And then how's this? Once I reached out to them and said, hey, what's going on? They said, oh, we can't fulfill it because we actually ran out of stock in the store. Okay, well, clearly that's not that. That's really illustrating what you're saying is that the ERP or the system that's managing the stock is not aligned with the actual website and the experience of buying something. Then that is just going to destroy your brand. I'm like, that's really frustrating. But to make matters worse, oh my goodness, They said, well, there is product in another store. The other store is only a 20-minute drive down the road. But they said, unfortunately, you can't just go and pick it up. We have to transfer it from one store to another, and then you can come and pick it up. And by the way, we won't give you a refund for the Uber driver that you purchased on top for delivery. Now, that experience to me is probably one of the worst e-commerce omnichannel experiences I've ever had, particularly because the misalignment between store to store, like not being able to just pick up something and make it as convenient as possible for me, the misalignment with Uber, with not being able to create a refund, and then also the misalignment with this, the product in-store stock and what's available or what was shown to be available on the website. And I would say that's a pretty normal e-commerce experience. I would say that a lot of folks, they experience a lot of that, not with the top tier, but with a lot of the middle tier brands.
Yeah, no, I'm sure you're right. And of course, you know, you then wonder why some of these e-commerce startups struggle, because you ain't going back there. And you know, although I've been a bit sniffy about Amazon, you cannot. And I'm only ever sniffy about Amazon about the slightly disingenuous point that we are the most customer-facing organization in the world. Because in terms of making stuff happen, getting that laptop to your door, they are, in my experience, without parallel. We've got a bit of an issue going on here in the UK at the moment. I don't know if you've got the same thing in Australia, which seems that in the holiday season, people are stealing the packages.
Oh.
So my daughter ordered an Xbox the other day, and when she opened the box, in it was a box of Surf detergent.
Oh, no way. Okay.
Yeah. So,
I mean, so someone took it out of the box and then put detergent in there instead.
Really, the box was sort of all bashed and battered. Anyhow, they rang the Amazon call center, and it was all handled, and another one was delivered the next day. So it was very well handled.
Yes.
But I think that, you know, that's the only example I can think. My other favorite story, and it's in the book, but I tell it because it's just such a great story, is a friend of mine who researched online. In fairness, I don't know whether this was Amazon, but researched online one of those Japanese wash and brush up heated seat toilets. You know, you're looking at me. I have the advantage of being able to see your face. You're looking at me like I've got no clue what this guy is talking about here. What the wash and brush up's not saying. So these are loos that have a heated seat, a built-in bidet, and a dryer.
Okay. Yes,
you are looking
in Australia.
you are looking suitably shocked. Yes. Anyhow, this guy decided he needed one of these.
Okay.
So he did the research.
Yeah.
And he went and he bought a $3,500 toilet, and then was blitzed for the next 6 months with advertisements for this product, and was heard to utter the immortal phrase, "How many $3,500 toilets do they think a man needs?" The answer to that question, of course, is none, but he was certainly daft enough to buy one. So, you know, that is just frustrating. In fact, our chairman rather amusingly tells a similar tale where he was in New Zealand, and his sister in New Zealand was having a Cinco de Mayo party, a 5th of May celebration party. And so he ordered sombrero and all sorts of stuff for this party so he could dress up and he could be part of it. And for years afterwards, would be sent stuff about sombreros and ponchos and, you know, and he says, you know, what are they thinking of that they just keep doing this? It was a slightly daft moment.
There's so much money in all those ads, so wasted. People are paying for it to be there.
Yeah.
It is interesting. So anyhow. We've always got a horror story. And I think the point we're trying to make here is that when it comes to brands and what customers remember about a brand, it's always going to be the worst experience they've had. Yeah. It's because that's just, it has the most salience, has the most pain, it's most memorable, it's easier to call back. It's also clearly, as we've been talking about our horror stories, it's so easy to talk about, people like to share them. And so there's all of these compounding effects when you can't actually deliver the experience that you should be delivering for your customer, because it impacts word of mouth. It impacts, your own perception of the brand, the possibility that they may never return as a customer that continues to shop with you. So there's all of these impacts of not getting it right. So on the flip side, it's like, okay, if you're not doing omnichannel, then there's probably something wrong, in a lot of ways, because omnichannel is just another way to say customer centricity by harnessing data and technology, and also building actually for the experience of a consumer. And so I want to talk a bit more about the data and understand, I guess, how you guys think about using data in the context of omnichannel, because let's face it, right? Most e-commerce retail businesses have multiple sources of data. They've got a huge customer journey. They've got all of these interactions that happen within and without a store. Now, how do you guys think about using data in the context of omnichannel? What kind of guidelines do you guys provide in terms of use and responsible use and collection of that data, and then activation into experiences?
Because I'd rather talk about, I'm a bit like Sarah, think about it from your point of view rather than think about the technology, because the technology ultimately becomes the servant that enables these things. I just want to go back to your point about brands are held in people's brains and bad experiences are what they remember and are very destructive. I've operated for most of my life in managing brands with this concept of it being like a checking account. And what you're trying to do all the time is you're trying to fill that checking up account up with a fund of goodwill. By doing, and if you think about it, I hate to say it, but the reason why the Tesco strategy was called Every Little Helps is because we don't cure cancer, we don't educate your kids, but in millions of small ways, we try and make your life better. That was the reason it was called Every Little Helps. And so what you're doing all the time is you're building this fund of benevolence in order that you can then, when you do have a snafu, because you will have a snafu, it'll dent that balance, but it won't take you to an overdraft. And they'll go, oh, well, they let me down today and it was really bad, but they recovered the quit situation quite well. And by and large, they've looked after me really well over the years, and you carry on and you rebuild. Yeah. And that, I think, is the way to think about creating and maintaining brand value. Coming back to your data point, using data is the most scientific way to go down that journey of creating this fund of benevolence, because you can spot things and you think, oh, if I did that, that would be really thoughtful. And not everybody, but some people will go, oh, that was clever of them. Oh, I like that. If you go back to the sort of real 101 of this, the ability to work out that people have had children and to change their coupons for vodka and lager to coupons for nappies and, baby powder. When you do that to somebody, they go, stone the crows. That is really cool. That is really clever. Now, what you're doing now, hopefully everybody's doing that now. But of course, if you haven't got customer data and if you haven't got customer connection and if you're not bothering to find out, then you can't do it because you've got no idea. Just one of the wildebeest that wander through your store took a few more nappies or diapers. You don't know which one. You don't know where it just happened. Which is what old school self-service retailing is about. You know, for some reason, the herd is moving more down this aisle than it used to, and is more buying more things from this aisle. But is it a few people buying a lot, or is it a lot of people buying a little? You know, maybe you can get some penetration data by studying baskets, but you can't really tell who's doing it. And actually, going back to it further, because you, most people don't come at this from the point of view that you've come at it. The most important thing is not the technology. The most important thing is that the mindset that it enables the business. So another favorite story, and I can't remember whether it's still in the book now, Sarah, but is the Prosecco story. Prosecco is very popular in the UK. And it's sort of, I'll probably get myself in trouble here, but it's sort of perceived to be the girls' drink, girls' night out, get on the Prosecco. And what you find when you do the analytics is the Prosecco that sells is the cheap one. So basically what you there's not much brand loyalty. So what you really need to do is you need to make sure that you have a really good promotional program, a really good secondary display program. And if you do all those things, you'll have a good market share in Prosecco and you'll do well. Except there's one brand that is that where there is, at a low level, a very high level of customer loyalty, but it doesn't sell that much. So if you were just looking at the volumes, you'd go, well, we'll discontinue that. Mm-hmm. And that brand is Asti Spumante. And the reason why it's Asti Spumante is because your gran is still buying it. Mm. You know, she's bought it for 30 years and she keeps buying it.
Yep.
The minute you know it's your gran that's buying it, you think, I'm not sure we should discontinue that. Because there's that category of older customer. And actually, I tell you what, I'm a bit of a marketing guy. Let's do an analysis and go around the store and see the categories and the products where there's a significant overweighting of older people. So you go down and you do that work. I guarantee you, if you then do the analysis on volume, many of those products would be on a hit list. They're going to get discontinued. Because they're old news, they're not new news.
Yep.
But the trouble is that suddenly you end up alienating 3 million, 4 million people who are over 65.
Mm.
And that suddenly, and it never happens like one day. They don't all one day say we're not shopping there anymore. But slowly they drift away.
Mm.
Your sales are not that good. Things not that great. What's going on? Scratch your head, sack the CEO, you know, because you just don't know.
Mm.
And so, but I think there's, we used to have an expression back in the day was, there's one thing worse than not knowing, and that's knowing and not doing.
Mm.
But not knowing is a, if you can know and you don't, because you can't be asked, you're too lazy, you're not inquisitive enough, you ain't going to run a good business.
Mm.
You have to be inquisitive. And the moment that you want to be inquisitive, you say, oh, there's this way of capturing data about customers. I've got to do it. Now, that was a very long preamble to the question that you asked, which... But which was, and I think you're sort of moving towards your I think you called it omniscient, but, you know, this yes. sort of big brother, what do you do, what do you do?
Mm-hmm.
If I was being cynical, which I shouldn't do, and you can probably tell I'm not normally cynical, what I would say is, you'll be amazed how much access people will give you to their innermost secrets, providing you create enough value.
Interesting.
You know, it, so it is a give and a get. If I give my data, what do I get for it? If I give my data and I get, and as a result of giving my data, I get spammed with irrelevant ads, I ain't giving my data for very long. If I give my data and I get a special price on a product that I was going to buy that shopping trip, you think, wow, that's cool. You know, if I give my data and I get information about a new product, which actually I'm really interested in because their algorithms say if I should be interested in it, and their algorithms are good and they're right, that adds, you know. So I think the important, and so what you have to do is you have to set customer satisfaction measures around your data that says, if I send people stuff and they don't use it, I'm not creating any value. So it's about how many coupons get redeemed, how many articles get read, you know, how many prices get activated. And you need to set targets for those things and make sure that the combination of what you're sending out is attractive enough so that you achieve those levels. Then I think people will do it. Because, and I think one of the reasons that they'll do it is because they're not daft. And they know that if I want to shop with Amazon, I do it by default. As soon as I'm on the site, they've got my ID, they've got everything. Where I go, what I look at, where I've been, where I'm going. And if you, it's interesting, you see, because if you take that view of the world and that philosophy, which basically says, of course we know who you are because it's the only way we can do a good job. Then they actually say, We won't even let you into our physical bricks and mortar stores without logging in. You can't get through the door. So, you know, and I think that's a very interesting insight into the difference between a digital first view of how you run a business and a bricks and mortar first view, which is, the whole point about our place is if you don't want a loyalty card, you don't have one. It's anonymous. You know, interestingly, going to your point, we've got a thing going on in the UK at the moment where in order to drive swipe rates up on loyalty cards, people are offering access to very sharp promotional prices, but you've got to have a loyalty card. So there's a thing going on. I saw an article yesterday which said Baileys, which is, you know, that creamy, whiskey-y, after dinner, glug it down at Christmas, perfect, just what you need. Granny will sleep on the sofa job. It's an absolute national disgrace. The price has gone up from last year from £15 to £21. You know, rip off, Britain is back. And then in the small print, it says, unless you've got a loyalty card, in which case it's £11. So last year it was 15, this year 11, last year 15, okay. You know. Okay. And they're saying, you know, they're just bribing you to get your data and all that. But, yeah. I mean, they're giving you a very, very, very good price. And if you don't want to do it, you don't have to do it.
Yes.
But so I think that, and the reason they're doing that is because they want to capture more data, because the more data they capture, and it's not data for data's sake, it's because the best way to run the business is to know more about more of their customers.
Yeah, I think there is a tension there. I think there is a big tension between how much do you really need to know about a customer and their shopping habits to provide a high quality experience. And how much do you actually just want for the sake of collecting it? And I think I find a lot of retail brands have the struggles. Like, they collect the stuff because they feel as though they might need it. It's like an insurance policy. It's like, oh, we may need X and Y data point for thing because you never know, we may have a use case for it. And I find that the more successful retail brands are the ones that take a very pragmatic approach. They think about, as you say, the success quotient for a data collection and data strategy is actually about the customer success. How does it lead to tangible outcomes for the customer? in a responsible way than which you use it. You know, I look at things like a massive tangent on this is, you know, retail media and the growing walled gardens of Amazon and even, you know, other retailers out there exploring using media and selling ads, of course, because third-party cookies is going away. So, you know, brands will want more opportunities to get in front of customers, whereas a lot of traffic heading, well, there's a lot of e-commerce stores around the bigger retailers. So you can see that, like, the value proposition of collecting more data is not just in driving customer success, it's actually to drive ads and to drive other things. It's also to give more insight. Regardless, gives you more of a view of where do we pull the levers, which categories.
Sorry, I'm going to cut you off because you made a classic.
Yeah,
I don't know what to say.
Go for it. No,
you made a classic non-omnichannel mistake in what Ooh. You said there.
Okay,
which is what you said is yes. All these retailers, they've got great big websites. It's all fantastic.
Yep,
they've got physical buildings. They've got assets. And they have to bring the physical buildings and the digital lens that lies over the physical building
mm-hmm.
to bear on this retail media proposition.
Of course.
Because otherwise,
yes.
they've got a tiny website and Amazon's got a massive one. You know, whereas yep. if you start bringing in the mm-hmm. 50, you know, the huge penetration that these physical stores attract, and make that part of the solution because you are omnichannel, then you create a much, much bigger entity. So frankly, anybody can sell banner ads on their websites and recommend a recommendation program on their websites. How you build it into the fabric of your restaurant, your car showroom, your supermarket, your drugstore, that's where the real value is for bricks and mortar retailers. And that's what we're trying to enable and help them to do. Sorry for interrupting.
That
is the point, you see.
Yeah, it's a fantastic way of thinking about it because I guess where my perspective is, well, a lot of the programmatic, the scalable type of media, which is low touch, is, of course, on digital channels, which e-commerce, right? And the linchpin, I think, was COVID-19 in the sense that a lot of customers went out of the store because they had to, and they went online. And then a lot of retailers were just trying to keep up with the demand with using e-commerce in places that not, you know, didn't get as much traffic as they had previously. And so it sort of spun up this concept of retail media or commerce media, which is, you know, it's been around forever, right? Like there's always been ad sales going on in stores. You know, there's always been ad placements. There's always been prioritization of products based on spend. So there's the whole concept of running ads in a store is not foreign. It's just the digital component, which, yeah, I mean, look, there's a handful of retailers in the world, Amazon, perhaps Tesco, Walmart, Carrefour, and then a few others that are, you know, they've got the scale. They've actually got the volume of customer data to actually build quite a big ad business. You know, I think over 2020 and 2021, Walmart was one of the fastest growing ad networks in the world. But they grew faster from 2020 to 2021 to 22 than Google and Meta. So you look at that, you're like, that's a, like, you know, Walmart's a very interesting example because they're very down that path of building proprietary technology at this point. But it is interesting to think, well, you know, the data collection incentive is very complex because the ethical and the moral imperative is like, yeah, we want to collect data so that we can drive a better experience. And the business imperative could be we want to sell more ads or we want to have personalized ads better, have a better proposition. But also we want to be able to drive better conversions and run better experiments and being able to see which categories and products work better or not. But I think, Tim, what you've been saying so far is that all of that depends on context. You can't make an assumption just based on sales volume that one product is better than others because you can alienate a bunch of customers. And let's face it, retail is one of the, you know, it's one of those commodity parts of any economy where you just need it to work. You know, it's like airlines, it's like pharmacies, it's like them, it's like health, you know, you need it to work. People rely on it every single day. And so it's one of these things where, you really need to take an ethical view on how you're collecting your data. And I love your perspective that it really should be on delivering a customer experience first and foremost.
Yeah. And I think that,
go ahead,
you
know,
you sorry, Sarah. Go on.
No, I was just going to say, in the second edition, we added a final chapter called The Culture of Loyalty, which is all really about this stuff and how you set the right guardrails and talks about the golden rule. So the essence of personalization is to treat people the way they want to be treated. And how do you make sure you do that? And we talked about, you know, people will let you be creepy if you are giving them value. And as part of that chapter, we interviewed a guy called Matt McClellan, who's running the new data and loyalty business at Asda, who have been part of the Walmart group for forever and got sold 2 years ago. So it's their first foray into data and customer understanding. And, you know, that's 25 years later than their key competitors in the UK. And he talks about whether he's got a very strong data background and customer centricity. And but he says the only reason we want customer data is to make their lives easier and to give them value. And ultimately, that should drive great results for the business. But that's the business case that they've built and is around customer satisfaction, doing the right thing, providing value. And I think that's what hopefully we'll see more of, is that the people who are winning are the people who are using the data they collect to do the right thing, to make your life easier, to make it faster to shop with them, to give you information about products and recipes and services that you like. It's becoming more than just buy this today. It's about the whole thing, kind of sums up to that point of the brand lives in your head. It's much easier to create a brand that I like that lives in my head if you're using my data to reflect yourself in my mind than it is without it.
Yeah,
I think that's a very good,
it's fascinating, isn't it? Because you think about it and you're like, how could you ever think of, say, just orchestrating data, doing campaigns, running website experiments, doing in-store placements? You know, all of that stuff ladders up to almost an ethical moral philosophy of your business. You know, and what way do you want to serve your customer? You know, I worked with a brand years ago and we were talking about data privacy and data collection and, you know, regulations that are coming up. And they said, you know, hey, you know, we'll just wait until the regulation comes. So, well, one of your brand values is safety. You know, like you're one of the things that your customers really rely on you to do is to provide them with a safe environment. Now, how does that extend to data collection practices? It's that drawing that empirical line between what's the value, what's the philosophy, the moral imperative, and how does that trickle down, which is something I don't think we talk about very much at all.
No, and which is why, you know, sorry to be boring about which is this point about treating people the way they want to be treated, exactly, the way they would expect to be treated, which is in a rather fractured and difficult world, is one of the few almost universal views that people take. It spans all religions, all cultures, hundreds and hundreds of years, with certain very rare exceptions where there are certain tribal cultures where, nah, it's our tribe and stuff the rest of them. You know, but most cultures say treat people the way they want to be treated. And so if you set that at the center of everything that you do, and you make it clear to people that's what you're doing, and then even if you don't tell them, and you can tell them, they will know that's what drives your data strategy. And then they will see it every day in the output of your data strategy in terms of the way you communicate with them. And, you know, we're absolutely in the foothills of this, I think, in terms of what ultimately people will do. We've spent a lot of time talking about Amazon. You've talked a little bit about Apple. I've got an Ultra iWatch, the new, you know, I don't think we're on
Apple
screen,
Watch?
But
you know, yeah, the Apple, you know, Watch Ultra,
but the new big one, and with a particularly big face. Which, to be honest, the screen on this thing is not much. Is probably actually, if you remember your Nokia, whatever it was, the screen is as big as that Nokia. Admittedly, it's portrait, not landscape, but the screen itself, and of course it's color and everything else. I think that increasingly we will all have these. They may even get bigger. I could see them sort of, you know, really becoming, because people have had a go at glasses. Glasses, maybe they'll come back, maybe they'll work. Headphones, I think, do work. Clearly, people spend a lot of time with headphones in. But this is this point about shopping being a phone in the hand rather than a phone in the purse or phone in the pocket activity. I like that because as an author, I like alliteration and I like all the P's. But actually, I think it's going to be watch on the wrist activity. But basically, people increase. My point made slightly facetiously earlier in the interview of, you know, my first experience of the day is a digital experience. I do actually think that's true. And I think that increasingly people will believe that they need to be connected 24/7. Apart from anything else, because their health monitoring will all be being picked up and collected and analyzed 24/7, you know. And I think one of the things, and there was an article in the British press about somebody recently, but, you know, people just would not dream of getting in their car today and not putting the zip code or the postcode in of where they're going if they don't know the journey intimately. And even if they know the journey intimately, they may well put it into Waze because they may feel, I just need to know if I need to get around any problem. You would be mad not to. It's just, you know, it's just become completely part of our life. I think other digital tools and processes will become completely part of our lives. And one of them that I think that will become a complete part of our life is what we call marketing in the moment, which is basically take all this data. So I know a lot about you and I know the right thing to do. But what I don't know is I don't know the context. But as I start being able to, you give me permission to track where you are, what you're doing a bit more closely, I now understand more about the context. And I can literally fire you the marketing message that you need now. You know, when you buy your train ticket, you get a marketing message that says half price coffee between 10 and 10:30 on the train type of thing, whatever it may be. And we believe that real-time marketing or marketing in the now, marketing in the moment, it's got many names, but you get my drift, will do to marketing what Near Me Search did to search. If you think about search before Near Me, I mean, it was completely transformed by Near Me and doubled and quadrupled the number of searches that Google were getting by combining their search technology and their mapping technology and putting them together. I think the same thing will happen to marketing. The same thing will happen to health. And I think it'll probably, I mean, I'm quite keen on this wrist thing, but in some way, shape or form, consumers will want to be connected.
You know, there's a funny story about what you're talking about there around the search and the Near Me. There's a restaurant, a Thai food restaurant in New York, and it's pretty famous now because they named it Thai Food Near Me. And if you think about it, it's a brilliant strategy to hack SEO, right? Thai food Near Me, if you're in New York. What are they going to get? Very good, right? Get them Google search. So, but I think what it underlies that, like that joke or the idea of doing something like that is marketers increasingly will build for machines. They'll create things in order to appease a machine and not a person. And I think that that's one of the challenges where I think a lot of the work here around data-driven marketing, you know, and obviously you wanting to deliver experience, it's great for a customer. However, when you see how search is evolved over time, it's increasingly being hacked by very savvy marketers and digital folks that know how to rank very well in SEO. In the same way, you have social media influencers that know how to rank very well with TikTok, in the same way that you see with Spotify, and a lot of the music sounding very similar these days is because folks have clued into what the algorithm likes and what it doesn't like. Now, what that creates for the consumer is an environment of homogeneity, and the algorithmic determination of things will force human behavior to do certain things that trends and very well. And so the unique, the quirky, the unusual, the slightly left of field, those things kind of get left out in the cold. And so in my view, like philosophically, there's this interesting way of thinking about this is that, yes, we want to deliver something that's for the customer and personalized into them and at one-to-one level. That's all really great. However, there are so many incredible experiences for customers when they stumble on something in a grocery aisle, or when they see something or they smell something in a store and they're like, well, what's that? You know, there's an element of discovery that's missing when everything is aligned to personalizing based on their own interests and giving them more of what they already want or have already purchased. But I'm not sure if you have a comment on that, because I think it's an interesting way of thinking, like omnichannel, yes. However, introducing tension, introducing friction sometimes can actually be a good thing for the experience.
I would agree completely, in the sense that if you're wandering around one of the great cities of Europe, mm-hmm. and you happen to see a church and you go into it and you see something and you go, wow, that's amazing. Look what I discovered. You almost feel better about that discovery than going to see the main thing that you went on your list to see because you needed to tick it off and say, I came. So I completely agree with you. I think it's a slightly contrarian view.
Mm.
And I think it's more a reflection of you as an individual. And frankly, if our personalization is any good, we should say, you know, okay, Juan, you're so clever. You find it, mate, you know, and that's what our personalization will do. And say, if you find it, take a pic, send it to us. We'll give you we'll give you double club card points. I do hear you.
I do
see your point about, but I think generally personalization is trying to do the opposite of that.
Mm.
It's not trying to sell everybody vanilla.
Mm.
You know, it's talking to people who don't have very much money about how they can get the most for their dollar.
Yes.
It's talking about people who do have money and are interested in a particular category, what's new, what's different. I think it generally, I think
is if it's governed by the right principles as a starting point. I think that's the difference, that it will do the right thing if you set the parameters and set the data science and ambition to do the right thing. If you're optimizing an algorithm to just get more listening hours or something, maybe it will be optimizing not to make every single person have the perfect song, but to have a more generic song that has mass appeal, you know. So I get both points are right. I think it comes down to what is governing your strategy, and if your strategy is to do the right thing, you'll get a better outcome than selling everyone vanilla.
This is quite an unusual interview, isn't it, Sarah, in the sense that we've actually talked much more about what we think really matters, which is the culture and the environment and the alignment and the business mission and all of that, of which the technology is the servant.
Mm. I agree. However, I would agree, but so technology has a forcing function for culture. People will align around technology. And my view is that with, say, for example, you know, Jira Atlassian, right? So they took a concept which was a philosophy around business, agile ways of working, developed for software, right? It's a concept for software development. However, they enshrined it in software. They introduced Kanban cards and sprints and squads, you know, and all these different technologies. And then you see a lot of enterprise companies now use Jira and Atlassian, Confluence. They use these tools, and it's almost a culture, a methodology enshrined in software. And so I think it's both, that technology has a forcing function on how people think about what they value as well, as you say, that the tools are usually the servant of whatever the strategy and the vision and the values are.
Yeah, I think, I think that's a very good point. And we operate to many of those principles. And one of the things that we've tried to do is to take them outside of just the world of software, but to think about, you know, that software is a project. This is how you manage the project. Well, we have other projects, but don't necessarily involve software. What can we learn? How can we be more agile? You know, and I think generally it's been good for us as a business. I think it's made us a better company. Yeah. So I'm not against a bit of thought leadership. No, I think you make a good point, but I think that the reverse, I think, happens. Mm. Where people say, if I buy the technology, everything will be sorted.
Yes.
And that absolutely isn't the case. You can't do it without the technology, but it's what you do with the technology that makes the difference.
Hmm. I think so too. I think that you could use 25% of say Eagle Eyes or software. You can use 25% very strategically and very well, and you get a much better result than trying to use all of the features, everything at once. And you see that time and time again. It's just, it always comes down to the strategy. It comes down to the culture, the ability to actually deliver, operationalize. All of that stuff is so much of it is just a people problem. It is a way to align people, to inspire them, to give them good incentives. And, you know, a lot of that, it just feeds down into learning the technology and getting the job done. So it has been a fascinating conversation. And I think we could have gone on for many hours here about the philosophy of Omnichannel and how it sits. But this has been perhaps for us, one of the most interesting conversations, just because we're taking a concept that everyone kind of has sitting in their mind, which is Omnichannel. And we've really tried to tackle how to define that and make that more less of just a tactical, what do you do with it, but more of a, how do you align it with a vision for your business? And how strategically, does that influence what you do? And so I have one final question for you both. You've got the new book, the second edition of Omnichannel. Omnichannel Retail, How to Build a Winning Stores in a Digital World. Now, where can we find that book and where can we engage with you online if we wanted to have a conversation beyond this podcast?
Well, you can find it on Amazon. and how do they engage with us, Sarah? I'm a hermit. You can't engage with me. How do they engage with us?
On LinkedIn, on our eagleeye.com website, and as per the earlier exclusive, you will be finding the Golden Rule blog coming probably via LinkedIn at you from January.
Oh, fantastic. So check out the new newsletter/blog and also the new book, Omnichannel Retail, How to Build Winning Stores in a Digital World. That's a second edition. And at Making Sense of MarTech, we interview folks all the time, folks like Tim and Sarah that are really thinking seriously and deeply about the direction in which our wonderful industry is going in marketing technology. So if you'd like to subscribe, hit that button. And also, we'd love to see a review if you enjoyed this episode. But to wrap us up, Tim and Sarah, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.